top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Before your funeral, and your coffin lid is closed, before you are buried, and your flesh turns cold, before you are covered with the last shovelful of dirt, be sure you are really dead. Mortuary.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 298, 1983's, although it started filming in 1981, Mortuary.
Had to be. That disco sequence cannot be filmed in any year other than 1981.
That's
amazing, too. I just want to say, because this film has a roller boogie sequence for the ages, right?
Make it sound like there's tons of competition out there for that subcategory.
Well, I mean, there's Boogie Nights, Rollerball, whatever. But it was plopped right in the middle of a horror movie. And it made me thinking, what genre, other than perhaps comedy, can you do that? Can you plop a roller boogie scene like that with a guy in a Silver Lame tuxedo doing his best John Travolta impression in the middle of the dance floor? Can you do that in a costume drama? Imagine that in Little Women.
Yeah.
Wouldn't happen. Only in the horror genre does that happen. God bless it.
Well, I'm glad we got the Louisa May Alcott reference out of the way this early in the podcast. It was inevitable that would come up. I can't believe Little Women. My mind is blown.
Well, do they ever say in Little Women, do they ever have the line, "Come on, Mr. Boogeyman, let's boogie"?
I boogied down to this one. I thought it was really fun. It had like a shaggy dog feel to it.
Yep.
I would almost liken it, even though they're dissimilar genres, but to maybe Spookies and maybe Hell House or even Night of the Creeps. Like, it has this fun, silly, like, you can't take it too seriously feel.
No.
It's all over the map. And we should say, I guess, how we came to this. And it's, of course, through the poster, which has a very 3D kind of dynamic feel with the hand reaching out from under the ground.
Very, very misleading poster nonetheless.
Yeah.
We talked about the Final Terror a few weeks ago that had a misleading poster, and one had a misleading poster because this one makes you feel as if it's going to be a zombie film, as if bodies are going to be rising from the grave, whereas there are bodies.
And they're going into the grave.
They're going into the grave because this film revolves around a mortuary.
Yeah.
And like the title suggests.
Yeah, well, it should have been. Yeah, the poster suggests a cemetery, although there is Christopher George, so City of the Living Dead, this is not.
This is his last cinematic role.
Yeah, and that's kind of a pathetic one it is, but very funny. This one involves, I texted you, I said this is a little bit of Phantasm meets the Seventh Seal, because there's this character skulking around in a death kind of outfit.
Mm-hmm. In my opinion, he looked more like the demon in The Exorcist and the subliminal flashes.
Oh, Mr. Boogity. We've referenced now six movies. I would say this film,
because I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, Phantasm, Seventh Seal, I don't see it. But then you said it's like Phantasm meets Seventh Seal, but not
insofar as there's a morgue attendant, a mortician. So you got that, and he does cut a very Seventh Seal kind of death type figure. Although I could even, there's a little bit of Dr. Fives in here.
A spoiler there.
There might be. I was thinking, geez, how many movies could they possibly reference and tap into? Like, this was a genre hopper all the way. There's even giallo elements with the black glove and some POV skulking around the bushes. This is
although
a weird
really
one.
Although there was no red herrings. It really was not a whodunit. In fact, midway through the movie, the mother of the girl who's stalked by the killer even says, "Do you think it may be the person who turns out to be the killer?" So, Giallo elements aesthetically, perhaps, but not thematically.
And it's weird because the beginning of this film, it's like very sunny and it's poolside, and with a movie called Mortuary, you're not expected to be in the sun-kissed coast of California with a pool scene. Of all things, I did not expect some Malibu pool, and some guy is very unconvincingly beaten with a baseball bat and dumped into the pool to drown.
Beat on the breath, the baseball bat.
Oh, I was like, what is going on with this? Because this is the plot point that propels so much of the narrative insofar as the daughter is trying to figure out what happened to her father as he meets his demise in this most pathetic way. And I was going, okay,
well, at least
where
he wasn't wearing a Speedo
going?
By the pool. Yeah. That would have been even more pathetic.
But he was so tapped.
Our book
so
is called Death by Umbrella, and that would have been Death in Speedo.
He was tapped so gently. It was almost like a bunt in baseball.
Like a wiffle bat.
Yeah.
Like a bunt.
And so, yeah, you got this woman who's, you know, you're trying to figure out how she's involved. Like, is this a whodunit? What is going on? Is this a procedural? What does this man have to do with anything? And then it does a complete about face, and you have two characters skulking about in a mortuary. And I had to watch this back three times to figure out what the hell they were doing there. Mm-hmm. And apparently the one guy's back wages were not coming through or something, and he was trying to steal
tires.
And it's
why
like,
a
what?
Mortuary would carry a surplus of tires? I have no idea.
Safety
amongst
first,
the coffins, you've got the tires.
Maybe for the hearse? I don't know. Maybe. It was very bizarre. And he's trying to use this as kind of a negotiating point with the employer who's not paying him. I was
lost. Or it's a bit of restitution. He said he didn't pay me back wages, so I'm going to take these instead. Or
yeah, but what's weird is like the standard format for a slasher film, of which this is kind of, is where you have a couple people go and they meet their maker right off the bat. Well, these two do not meet their maker, really. One of them disappears, mm-hmm. and the other one wonders where the other guy went. And there was this big to-do at this mortuary, and they're skulking around, and they see
a seance.
And this is so bizarre, like a genre hopper. You're wondering, like, they're conjuring up something from beyond the grave, but yet they're not. Why is there... There's coffins, and yet that's not really playing a role.
Poor Christopher George, as Mr. Andrews, the owner of the mortuary, is leading the seance wearing, I don't know what you call
billowing
it.
Robe.
Sort of billowing, diaphanous. Well, it's not really diaphanous, but a black
robe. It was kind
robe.
Of judicial in a way.
Yeah,
right? It was a Judge Judy.
He looked rather pathetic in his final cinematic outing, I gotta say. But, you know, we all can't go out like...
I don't know, like Hunter S. Thompson into space or something?
Yeah,
I don't
there
know.
You go, yeah.
But I was wondering, like, okay, so you're in a mortuary, and no dead body shows up, and yet they're doing a seance in the mortuary. Like, but the mortuary is not particularly mortuary-esque. It's
no.
just some,
it
like...
It looked like a warehouse, basically.
Yeah, it was some Victorian-era brick warehouse, and you're wondering, why the seance? Why are they trying to one-up a scare that would be inherently felt in a mortuary? It's weird. Like, this is a... all over the map, and it turns out, I guess, one of the surviving, as it turns out, I guess, member of the party who's searching the mortuary is connected to the woman whose father met his demise in the first five minutes, and then there's this...
Well, he's her boyfriend.
The guy goes to this roller rink to ask this question about where his buddy could have gone to. Mm-hmm. I mean, meanwhile, he should know because they're in the mortuary, but this is an excuse for this...
Well,
boogie nights, boogie down of 15 minutes of like interminable going around in circles. It's like metaphorical
is,
for the narrative.
You gotta remember, not only does his buddy go missing, but so does his van.
Yeah.
So the suspicion is his buddy might have taken off with his van.
Oh, come on.
Which was later found at the sheriff's station.
Yeah, but it's so bizarre. And you're wondering, like, at the 30, 40 minute mark, where is this thing going were it not for this figure shrouded in cloud and wearing this billowing robe and skulking around in the bushes, mm-hmm. who is maybe you could surmise the killer of the father because he's going after the daughter and he's got a trocar in his hand. And I was thinking, like, is this Spanish verb conjugation, like trocar? Like, I was like, what is a fucking trocar?
What is a trocar?
Funny you should ask, but it's something that has a cannula inside which sucks liquid out of something, ostensibly a body.
So it's basically a...
it's a device used in mortuary. An implement.
It looks like a sword, basically.
Yeah, and he's wielding this thing, and I was like, what is this? And a mortuary
device.
Pretty
cool weapon, nonetheless.
Yeah, it was interesting. I think we were safe not to include it in Death by Umbrella, the 100 weirdest horror movie weapons.
Couldn't get them all, man.
Anything that punctures someone, you know, you have to pick your battles with that one. Like harpoon, maybe... trocar. I even feel like that's Portuguese or something. I can't even say it. I don't even know if that's pronounced properly. But it sort of telegraphs who the perpetrator might be. Mm-hmm. Like, duh. Some guy walking around with mortuary equipment.
Could possibly be the...
He could.
Mortician. I'm not spoiling. I'm just surmising. But...
But you have like 15 minutes of solid roller boogie interplay that could have really been... jettisoned altogether, but I really did appreciate
it.
It was
a lot of fun.
It was great. It was like Cool and the gang should have been like out there boogieing it up with them, but it was weird. I mean,
putting on their disco shoes.
Yeah, I always think of Disco Stew and his goldfish that are living in his platform boots, and it's like, well, not for long as it turns out. But man, that is funny. Like, first for me seeing a roller disco scene in a horror film that I know of. There's been disco scenes, obviously, in Prom Night has exactly. Leslie Nielsen shakes down on the dance floor. You know, Jamie Lee busts, you know, cuts a rug.
Leslie Nielsen, he throws down on the dance floor and he utters the word hotshot a million times in Day of the Animals. I mean, the guy has contributed so much to the world of cinema. Forget, well, yeah. There's
Airplane,
Naked Gun, Lieutenant Frank Drebin, whatever.
Yeah, but Call Me Shirley.
But between Hotshot and his disco dancing, the man is a gem. May he rest in peace.
What were you thinking when you were watching this? Like, this is this a supernatural? No. Is this a slasher? No. Is this a giallo? No. Is this a procedural? No. Is this a thriller? No.
Well,
what is this?
It's more, you're watching somebody who's being stalked by somebody else. The girl is still wondering who killed her father. She doesn't believe a police report that it was an accident, what have you.
That's what they said. Maybe. I mean, the sheriff on the case was not exactly...
The sheriff would look like he belonged in the Dukes of Hazzard. But anyway.
It's true.
Well, I mean, they didn't believe that her father was murdered, and she did.
Yeah.
So, and then you have this person stalking her who says midway through the film that he loves her, so you gotta surmise that there is a connection between the death of her father and the killer. And the killer is wearing makeup, but it's not enough to really conceal his or her, let's just say his identity. Because of the, what's the weapon called again?
The trocar.
You have to deduce that it's a mortician.
Yeah, there's only two people in this film who have anything to do with a mortuary, one being Christopher George, who's not exactly sprightly at this advanced age that he would have been in this film, maybe 70,
and
75.
Possibly ill of health because it was his last cinematic role.
Yeah, and we should say his wife is in it as well. Yep. As part
of
the course.
She was in Pieces as well. Yeah, they often appear in movies together. But Christopher George's son, Paul, is played by Bill Paxton.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of his, not his first role, but one of his earliest roles, and he just oozes star quality.
Yeah.
From the second he comes on screen, he blows everybody, every other no-name in this cast. I'm talking about the young people.
Yeah, exactly.
Away.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, he first came across my radar in A Simple Plan, which is really growing in my estimation, having seen it so long ago. Like, it's such a... And he was so amazing in that. But, of course, he was in Twister. He was in Terminator. He was like... maybe Weird Science, but
he was
I could be
Weird
wrong.
Science. He was in another horror film called Frailty. He was in... you mentioned The Terminator... Aliens. Yeah.
Yeah, and what a great role this is too. I mean, he's really.
He was in a lot of the Cameron films, actually.
Yeah, and he's just lapping up the role here and just standing out amidst all these. Well, George, notwithstanding, a bunch of nobodies from the soap opera world, and essentially that. So it's really. He's really carrying this whole thing.
Actually, the lead female, she was on The Waltons.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Never watched Walton, so I don't really know. But yeah, I saw that.
I'll take your word for that. Did they found Walmart? No, I don't know. with this one, I was like, I had to actually watch it back several times to figure out what was going on, because there's so many spaghetti theory elements just thrown into this, and you got the impression. I don't know if you know anything about the production, that this was the work of many hands and might have been in distribution hell or production hell for a period of years, because there's so many disparate elements that don't really come together. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if they had anything in mind that they were really going for before it was tinkered with in post or various. I really couldn't tell. There's really, it's going off in so many directions. And like, as politics has told us, you can't be all things to all people. But this is as much as any horror we've ever discussed on the podcast. There's a little bit of something for everyone in this. There's even some, like, a pretty gory kill for a movie that's not gory. There's some exploitation elements as well.
Even with some of the scenes in the mortuary when they're actually showing the embalming of a corpse and everything, mm-hmm. that's rather gory and not for the faint of heart. So, yeah.
You had a friend who was in, it was a roommate of one of our mutual friends, and she was quite a cute. Well, is blonde, blue-eyed, so very unobtrusive, very sweet, very wholesome-looking, and she was in the funeral services program, mm-hmm. and that always blew my mind that someone like that would be in that profession, because you always think, Shrim. Well, what's his name? Well, from Phantasm. And you always
Angus Grimm.
Always think of some hulking, potentially hunchbacked, aged, antediluvian, ancient figure in that role. And you don't expect, like at the time when I first met her, she was like 25. You don't expect someone young or vibrant or female, frankly, to be in this role. So it's good to, I don't know, discuss another mortuary theme movie, because again, Phantasm is like the pinnacle of that kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And this was just so funny on many levels, and they really made, I guess, some elements of the mortuary stuff work, because again, this Paul character is a bit of a pervo, and he takes great delight in not only firing formaldehyde into his patients, I don't even know what you call them, but also
clients, I guess.
Clients, yeah. I don't know. I makes me want to be cremated, but yeah, he like doffs their tops and they're obviously nubile, like, you know, very attractive women, and yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a, yeah, for all the exploitation elements, it's kind of a, there's lots of fun banter, and there's mm-hmm. a protracted sex scene that seems out of place.
Obligatory funny fat guy.
Oh yeah, yeah, and. You got an interesting, I guess, familial dynamic, given the demise of the dad in the beginning, because the mother refuses to believe that her daughter's life is really in danger, mm-hmm. despite her husband being offed. Actually, so that's a weird kind of thing.
Well, you got to remember, too, her mother was part of the seance, so she might have been part of the conspiracy as well. And for a lot of the movie, the mother is basically gaslighting her daughter, making her daughter think that she's crazy. Oh, it's your overactive imagination. Oh, it's your bad dreams. Oh, it's your sleepwalking. Nothing. No one's out to get you. Don't worry about it. Go back to bed.
Well, there was someone out to get her, and at first it was like Duel in the Spielberg. Like, he was some figure whose face you couldn't see, trying to run her off the road in California on the highway, and you're like, what's going on with this? I don't know if this is the point of the podcast where we get to what we've learned, because I've learned quite a bit of stuff.
The thing about me, man, is when I write, I always write down things that I learned, and then I blow my load as we're talking. And I mean, things that I want to say that I reserve what I learned, I say in the course of our discussion. But what I will say, one of the things I did learn, is that if you're going to reveal your killer early, as this film did, have something to make your film a bit more exciting from the time you reveal until the denouement, because they reveal the killer quite early, and we sort of reveal the killer as well. I mean, we did spoil the killer in this podcast.
Yeah.
Apologies to those who haven't seen the film, but it does get kind of boring after that until the last 5 minutes, which gets pretty fucking insane. However, it does sort of steal elements from Happy Birthday to Me. So as much as I love the last 5 minutes because for its derangement, I have to dock a point or two because of the fact that it did steal elements from a prior horror film.
Oh, I was going to say maybe Silence of the Lambs as well, with the tableau you're referring to that is put on for that. That was shocking to me. I was also going to point out, I thought you would, the famous composer from Salzburg, Austria.
Well, I was waiting.
Mozart. Yeah. Who would have thought that Wolfgang would feature so prominently in this shitty movie. It was weird because you see a figure on campus who's trying to pick up one of the principals in the film and try and court her using what else? I mean, the time-honored vinyl LP of Mozart under your arm?
In 81. All the disco dancing dynamos were into Wolfgang Amadeus. This is before Falco, of course.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
You know, Mozart hadn't been brought back into prominence at this point.
As an aside, I did see a screening of Amadeus accompanied by a live orchestra, which is really nice. quite moving. And I did visit Mozart's house in Vienna.
In Salzburg, as did I.
Well, not Salzburg, in Vienna, because he was born in Salzburg, but he spent a lot of time in Vienna.
I visited his birthplace in Salzburg. His house that he lived. I also visited his grave in Vienna, which is very nondescript, in the middle of an industrial area.
Whoa. And of course, Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen, named his son Wolfgang. I don't know why I'm bringing that up. It's so stupid. But during the tableau, and I think when they're running the credits, there's the incongruous playing of Eine kleine Nachtmusik,
which translates to
a little night music. It's like dun 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 dun. It's like
it's the most famous Mozart composition.
Yeah, but I mean, in a horror film, you're supposed to conjure up scares and frights, and that's what you're running in the final credits.
Never mind. I mean, the music in this movie is pretty damn awesome. It had a bit of a Phantasm vibe, I thought.
Oh, I agree. I said that to my girlfriend right off the bat. I said this maybe movie may not be much to look at. There's really not much in the way of narrative. The two main characters spend the bulk of the time.
There were boobs. It was a body double. And you could tell because the female protagonist was a redhead and the female on the mortuary table was a brunette.
Yeah, so the drapes didn't match the rug or whatever. Yeah, fair point. Mm-hmm. There was a very protracted fucking scene in, I believe, the parents' house, which I thought was rather odd. It must have been, because no one that young could afford such sprawling accommodations. Yeah, so I'm like, maybe you go in the basement, you can get away with that, but right in the middle, like, I think by the fireplace, in the living room, there's this, like, balls to the wall, like 10 minutes of fucking. And I thought, okay, like, aren't they worried about being caught in flagranto, whatever? Della, whatever. I always mix that one up, but yeah, I never did that in my parents' place. Like, I would not have the balls to do that in the living room. At least, like, show some discretion and go in the basement. But,
no, I'm playing the fifth on that one.
God, it was... what else did I learn? I'm trying to think here. I alluded to this rather violent death. So it's maybe a bit of a spoiler that the mother, I think, meets her maker at the hands of this mystery killer. And it's with the trocar. El trocar, por favor. The trocar is like penetrating her, but not in a way that was particularly bloody. Or it was just the constant shoving of the implement into her innards. It was actually, it was nothing gory about it, but it was quite shocking in the way he was. I mean, it was like almost a turkey baster. I didn't even know how to describe it. He just kept shoving it in. It was almost made me recoil. It was quite impactful.
No, it was much more gory when he was using the trocar in the actual embalming sequence earlier in the film.
Ooh, yeah. Not going to be filled with formaldehyde upon my demise. I'm going to make it explicit in my wishes to my loved ones, in my will, that I hope to be whatever, cremated or some otherwise. This movie is not contributing
to embalming is only done in North American society. There's no other society on the planet that embalms the deceased.
Really? Yep. So I guess ancient Egypt and now there's just the people that fell out of favor and then they're the last ones. I don't know.
Yep.
Weird. Mm-hmm. Trying to think what else I learned here. There's just so much. Christopher George, God love him. I mean, he was in Grizzly as well, which is another fantastic film we podcasted with Scott Drebbit, who wrote a fun article on Daily Dead about Mortuary.
It's very same film.
So, I mean, good God, like, we have so much. Like, we owe Christopher George so much. Like, he's been such a focal point of our discussions. And again, like, chewing on a stogie and like City of the Living Dead and wandering around and just basically the same disinterested authority figure, although this one he is a business owner,
right?
But it's the same kind of scowling guy just wandering around and he just is. There's something so, I don't know, comforting about his presence in a movie, and it just makes you smile.
It's like he's got that John Saxon quality, like every time you see him in a horror film. You're, or Lance Henriksen. You smile. You're happy. Yeah.
So did this one make you happy? Because this was, I mean, as much as I enjoyed it, I didn't take to it in the same way I did The Final Terror or these other films that we champion that no one else really does. Like, mm-hmm. I found it a little too disjointed, although some of the lines, as you mentioned one earlier, that was quite good. I don't know. Maybe I just wasn't in the mood.
I can't believe you didn't bring up the line, "What the hell's a Mozart?" You texted me that line.
Oh my God. Man, the standards are really slipping in post-secondary education if no one is familiar with Mozart. Yeah. But
well, Bill Paxton is holding a stack of records, mm-hmm. and one of them is Mozart, and one of the
the principals,
you know, picks it up and looks and goes, "Mozart? What the hell's a Mozart?"
Oh, and they couldn't even pronounce it right either. It's like, damn it. But I don't know, star rating here, because... Like I was trying to warm to it, but it was just too over the map somehow. It was
too all over the map.
No, but I really liked Spookies and even
Spookies makes no sense whatsoever.
No, when the poster on that almost conjures up the antagonist here, which is more of a Mr. Boogity kind of the Exorcist kind of vibe. I don't even know how you describe the killer really, but I think the tableau at the end really. Add some almost a Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I was
going to
say
it.
When you were mentioning the movies that it was similar to. I was going to say it did have a sort of TCM vibe. Man. I mean, the tableau is fantastic, but like I said, it wasn't wholly original. It was done earlier in Happy Birthday to Me. So, I mean, I liked the movie. I had fun with it. I loved the fact that you had a roller boogie scene in the middle of it. I loved the.
It was so much padding. No, I mean, that was really
very true. Very true.
Lots of, which shouldn't be a problem. Like all the sex and all the roller skating. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I liked it, but I didn't love it. And then, like I said before, when they revealed the killer, which was around the 60-minute mark, and there was still about 30 minutes left to go, and it was just padding and padding and pulling, like taffy, just pulling and pulling. And, you know, it's like they're making they're making homemade noodles, you know, just stretching and stretching and stretching until you got to the last 5 minutes with the Mozart and tableau and so on and so forth. So for the disco scene, for the what's a Mozart line, or what the hell's a Mozart, for some of the wacky elements, I'm going to give this one 3 stars and call it a day.
Nice. Well, as is par for the course with me all the time on the podcast, I always think of something just before I give my star rating of another thing I learned. Today,
Do tell, Chris.
Well, the late Mr. Paxton, a great actor, and it's a shame that he died so young. Cause he was on the Marc Maron podcast talking about his heart troubles, and it's I think the world took him from us at 60-something.
Maybe 61. The adjective you can use to describe Bill Paxton was dependable.
He was
always counted on. He never gave a stellar performance, but he always gave a solid performance.
Yeah, so just very very like to the letter, just an actor's actor, I guess the cliche would be. So I found out today that he's actually part of American history and lore, because as a young kid he grew up in Texas, and he was present on that infamous date when John F. Kennedy was murdered, and so he
assassinated.
So there's a picture of him as I believe a young child being held up by his parents to witness the proceedings. And so in the historical archives in Dallas, a picture of a 8-year-old Paxton being held aloft, hundreds of people looking at the motorcade. Cavalcade is something entirely different. My God, motorcade. So it's pretty funny that, well, not funny, haha, but he was part of history in that way. And yeah, a great actor and a pretty memorable performer. And of course,
picture that kid right now. It's such a famous photograph.
Yeah, and you always, like, there was that thing where he's being frequently confused with Bill Pullman, who was from
Independence Day.
Yeah, and all those other type movies. So it's just, but they were such different people. They don't really look that similar. It was more the name that I think SNL played off of and stuff. So he really, it was a vehicle to
kick. It's like John Hurt and John Hurd, two actors again that with very oft confused names.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm going to give this I'm going to give this a solid 3. And you know, perfectly fun time waster, and I was drawn in because, again, from back in the day, this was a poster that stuck with me and a movie that I never followed up on. And until much later. So very much like Hell House. or one of these type vehicles where it's like, whoa, that poster, I got to see this, got to see it. And then years later, I got around to it. And hell, you could throw pieces in there as well with Christopher George. So a solid...
And Linda Day George, his wife, yeah. His betrothed, tubes in this one as well.
So not exactly a wholehearted recommendation, but a sort of a tepid, you know, barely 2.75 out of 3, fun enough. And we have some announcements forthcoming. We're going to be... unveiling in spring, we hope to very soon anyway, and it's going to be pretty exciting. So continue to listen to new episodes of the podcast uploaded for your listening pleasure every Friday on the Really Awful Movies podcast, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.